Calling the meeting to order. Members, today is March 11th and the time is 1:01. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 9th, 2026?
I'd make that motion.
Okay, thank you, Representative Rapitsky. Moves to approve the minutes of March 9th and any discussion? Okay, seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes for March 9th, 2026 are approved. And so the first bill we have is House File 3521. And it's my bill, so I'm going to move up there. I'm going to want to move the bill. It's 3521 before the committee. What's that?
You can take it with you.
Oh, okay. There you go. Thank you. And our goal is to vote on this bill by 110.
What's that?
The goal is to vote.
105.
Well, since I'm the new chair, I want to vote on it by 105. So
yes, Chair Nadal, we will listen to you.
So Representative Backer has moved House File 3521 before this committee. We have it before us. Representative Backer, tell us about your bill and the changes. Tell us about your bill.
Yeah, we took public testimony on this bill on February 25th, 2026. So no further testimony will be done today. Basically, under other committee members asked that this bill would be laid over until we got the findings from MDH. And MDH came back saying it is to the public interest for the state to add the 84 beds for Regents. So that's why we tabled it. And now we have that feedback from MDH, and that's why we have moved to put it back on in front of the committee today.
All right. So I'm not aware of any amendments. Is there any further discussion on this bill? Hearing none. Representative Backer moves that House File 3521 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. House File 3521 recommended to be placed on the general register.
What's that? Oh.
It's House File 3521 as amended. We amended it last time. Anybody have any problems with this? Jack? Representative Liebling? We okay?
Mr. Chair, thanks for asking. I just don't recall that we amended it. How did we amend it?
Elizabeth.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, it was a technical amendment. It was to make level one, the one, be a Roman numeral instead of an Arabic numeral.
Oh, that's right.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No wonder I don't remember. Thank you. Thanks for reassuring me, Ms. Clark.
Thank you. I didn't remember either, so I appreciate it. All right. So it has House File 3521 is recommended to be placed. What? As amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. There.
Thank you,
Representative Backer.
Chair Nadal, you met your deadline.
I always mess it up when I'm up here.
Okay, today the second bill we have for consideration is House File 3563. Yes, we have 3563, Representative Anderson. Oh, no, Representative Knutson. Would you make a motion to get Representative Anderson's bill before the committee?
So moved.
Okay, cool. Representative Knutson moves that House File 3563 be recommended to be referred to the Committee of State Government Finance and Policy. We have the bill before us. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. Tell us about the bill, and our goal is to be voting on this bill at 1:30. That's our goal. And with that, go ahead, Representative Anderson, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it'll take 25 minutes. I was originally told I had 10, so I'll try to keep it relative.
Well, just in case there's debate, but go ahead. We would love the 10 minutes today.
All right. Thank you. Members, House File 3563 is fairly simple and straightforward. It requires a licensing board to take action to suspend or revoke occupational licenses for people that are convicted of certain crimes. The bill, it adds essentially mostly fraud crimes and theft. This is more normal in other, you know, states, and we need to be, if we're going to actually crack down on fraud and crime, we need to be serious about it. And so that's what this bill does. It's fairly simple. There is no fiscal note, and I know nonpartisan can potentially also go over the bill if there's members would like. I do have one testifier too who's on Zoom, and we can take that whenever you'd like.
Yeah, to all testimonies today will be limited to 90 seconds, and I got word that he just joined, so we have Scott Isaacson, President of List Transportation LLC, and Scott, you have the floor for 90 seconds. Can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Speak up a little louder.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Scott Isaacson. I'm a licensed NEMT provider in Minnesota and president of the R80 Transportation Coalition. I'm asking you support HF 3563. Fraud in this program continues because there's been no real consequences in the past. This bill begins to change that. I ask you to even strengthen it further. Credible evidence of fraud should trigger immediate license suspension. Conviction should mean permanent revocation and permanent disqualification from all 14 public assistance programs. The family member loophole also must be closed. Convicted providers are restarting operations under their spouses or relative names and continuing to defraud the system. Part of the reason this works for fraudsters is structural. MnDOT approves providers, DHS controls reimbursement, MCOs add their own layer, and no single agency is accountable for the whole picture. Fraud moves through those gaps by design.
30-second warning.
I also urge the committee to consider enhancing credentialing requirements for higher risk transportation categories, particularly methadone and addiction treatment routes. These are fertile grounds for kickbacks, and a higher bar for providers in those categories would go a long way towards cutting off fraud. Mm-hmm. This bill is a step forward. Please pass it, strengthen it, and make fraud in this program a career ending decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3563? Okay. I am unaware of any amendments to House File 3563. Further discussion, we have Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I am intrigued with this bill. I'm not sure it goes far enough. As your testifier there, actually, that's one of our, I think it's $24 million in fraud that we had on this area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I've been a part of that group, because I haven't. But, I know that space really well, and I don't know, you know, I have a bill coming up that's going to do maybe a little bit more and provide, and tell them to get into more training, because I think licenses is one thing, but I also think we should move to suspension once there's sufficient or mm-hmm. something that's going down. And I just, for this fact alone, I think we have to really push harder on these individuals, because these are services. This is what ticks many of my colleagues, all of us off. These are services that are meant for people. And to have the fraudsters take the money away from these services is terrible. So I really appreciate this bill. It's a step, but we still have a long way to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We also have Representative Carroll. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. And thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Anderson. A couple of questions. Is this going to the Fraud Committee? I missed where it was going to go.
Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carroll. Okay. It originally was in the fraud, but we were worried about deadlines. And so it doesn't need to go to the Fraud Committee. I think it, I guess.
We're going to state government.
State gov, yeah. We're just a little worried about deadlines. We expect that this will be wrapped into something, whether that's an expanded bill. I would love to go further with this and would love to work with you on that. So we can maybe do that by the time it gets to state gov. Okay. It could go to fraud, but it doesn't need to. So
really, it's a little surprising.
Well, this was originally referred to fraud, but we were worried about time and deadlines.
Yeah.
So that was the only reason that we actually re-referred it here.
And Chair, if I could, one more question.
You may go ahead.
So, why don't the individual licensing board deal with this? I'm an attorney, mm-hmm. and I tell you, if there's any fraud committed on my behalf, my license is going to get taken away mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. So I would think, isn't that the same case with these different professions?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative Carroll, it's not necessarily. And I don't know if nonpartisan has any research on, I mean, there's many different licenses, but it isn't necessarily the case, no.
Representative Kerquist.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's what this bill does. It's adding authority to the individual licensing boards to suspend or revoke a license of a health occupation or a non-health occupation if the individual is convicted of one of these offenses.
Follow-up, Representative Carroll.
Well, thank you, Chair. I'm just surprised that mm-hmm. there wouldn't be underlying authority to do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Just Chair Bierman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to that, my understanding is that the board would take action if there was a conviction of fraud already. So this is, my understanding is this would just be like adding suspenders to a belt that already exists.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Representative.
So what I understand about these non-emergent drivers, it's just a certification on the van at the DOT. They do not go through the health department. Mm-hmm. There is very minimal licensing, if any, on these individuals. And I think this is a good start. This has been going on for years. I mean, literally for years. And so I think that in this case, how many of these organizations that aren't licensed right now that basically are just a certification on the vehicle they drive and they do a background on the drivers like a CDL, mm-hmm. that's a whole different story. And so I wonder how many of those we find throughout the system.
Representative Chair Lieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following on that question for nonpartisan staff, are the people that we're talking about here, the drivers for the non-emergency medical transportation, are they covered under this bill? I was listening intently to our testifier, and I thought that what he was describing the bill would not really address. Can you help me with that?
Go ahead.
I was asking nonpartisan staff.
Yes, go ahead, nonpartisan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, no, I don't believe any EMT drivers would be covered by this. This covers people regulated by a health-related licensing board or people regulated by a non-health-related licensing board.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up?
Mr. Chair, so thank you. So obviously, I think that Representative Hewitt has identified a real problem. Mm-hmm. I agree. Over the years, that has been a real concern. Mm-hmm. But this bill doesn't address that. And I think, you know, it's a great effort. We all absolutely want to get the fraud out of our programs. And if you know, it makes people more comfortable to do the belt and suspenders, I'm fine with that. But just to recognize that this isn't moving the ball forward very much.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Lee. I would be, again, happy to broaden this. So I'm trying to get things done that we can actually get past here. So, but it sounds like there is a will here to broaden this, and so I will be happy to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea with an amendment. And our final discussion here before we go to a vote, go ahead, Chair Bierman.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest if we want to broaden it, maybe sending it to the Fraud Committee so they could do the work on it. They certainly have time. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, they've heard one bill this session, so they'd be wide open, I would think. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, right now we are referring it to the state government finance policy. There's a lot of stops and amendments can be added. So right now this is going to move to state government finance and policy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Final comment to the bill, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. As the vice chair of the Fraud Committee, I will commit that the Fraud Committee at some point will see it, but we need to hit our deadlines. So thank you.
Okay, with that, Representative Knutson moves that House File 3563 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Policy. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. And House File 3563 is recommended to be referred to the Committee of State Government Finance and Policy. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Now we have Representative Hewitt. You are on deck, and our goal is to vote for this bill at 1:35. Yep, 1:35. So that's our goal. So thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move House File 82 to get it before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would. What was that House number again?
I have House File 82.
Thank you. That's it.
Okay. Yep, we're on the same page. Thank you. So Representative Hewitt moves that House File 82 be recommended to be placed on the general register. We have the bill before us, members. Representative Hewitt, tell us about your bill, please.
Chair Backer, and thank you, members, because many of you probably have dealt with this issue before. It's definitely a scope bill that we have been trying and trying over and over again, and I don't think it's a great scope bill because everybody had to give on this. And it really did go into different parts of especially athletic medicine and rehab medicine. Whereas the trainer, back in the 80s, my trainer just taped my feet up and said, go out in the field, or to Rocky, had a trainer in his corner. That's not the typical trainer today. The typical trainer today is actually one that works with the healthcare team. Trainers have to have a medical director that oversees what they're going to do, sets their scope, and they become more of part of the care team. Now, they're not replacing the physical therapist, and the physical therapists actually have gotten to neutral on this bill, which is great. They're here today, I guess, not to testify, but they have another bill. But we finally came to a solid ground where they can really work together in conjunction. They're all a part of the team. What we're changing on this bill is basically it's a one-word subject in there that basically takes it from athletes to patients. And that's going to give them the ability to open up and be able to work in clinics. They can now, but this will give them more of a chance to do that. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, if we can adopt that.
Yes, we do have an amendment labeled A1. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move that amendment?
Right, and this amendment, I would, Mr. Chair.
Yes, okay, cool. Representative Hewitt moves the amendment. Labeled A1. Sheriff, tell us about the amendment.
This is the actual agreement that was came up between the trainers and the physical therapists, who again had to work through many issues in that. And so the A1 gets the bill in the place it needs, so there's peace in the valley.
Very good. We love peace in the valley, don't we, Representative Hewitt?
We do, because it makes us go faster.
Yes, thank you. Okay, Representative Hewitt has moved the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? Chair Lieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, it's nice if there's so-called peace in the valley, but I think the whole issue of whether one profession is stepping on the toes of another is only one question. And the other question is, you know, what this does for the public and so on. So I would really appreciate, Representative Hewitt, if you could go through the amendment a little bit, and or somebody could, so that we understand what changes are being made to the bill as it has been out in the public.
Sure, Chair Becker.
Representative Hewitt, go ahead.
Representative Liebling, thank you for that question, and I think that's really fair. I'm going to try to touch on it, and then I believe I have a testifier here that can also talk about it. Right, peace in the valley is one thing, but our job here, like we talked about the other day, is to protect the public also, and to make sure that people that have hands-on have the training they need in the scope of the practice they're going to be in. And so it's just like Representative Becker and I both are EMTs, there's paramedics. Again, there's areas there that have advanced. This area here, they've advanced, but they haven't been able to get anything through us since 1993, I believe it is. Is that right? Mm-hmm. All right, so got it. And it really goes to play that it's time, because many of them are doctors, most of them are masters, and the other side is the, you know, it only requires a four-year degree, but they do have the training, they can work in a clinic safely. And the other thing, like paramedics and EMTs, they also need a medical director. So there's a real good scope over this. But I'll have the AT tell you a little bit more about it.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Kate Tabor. I'm the Government Affairs Chair for the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association. Representative Liebling, to answer your question, the definition of athletic training is one of the major things that was updated in the amendment. So in our conversations with the physicians, the chiropractors, the physical therapists, we got to an updated definition of what athletic training is. We utilized definitions that currently exist through our national certifying board, so our board of certification, the group that credentials our education requirements, the KAD and the National Athletic Training Association. So the definition of athletic training that you see in the amendment comes straight from the Board of Certification, which is the group that certifies and credentials us from a national standpoint. And that was the work that we did over the last couple of years to get to that agreement on what the definition of an athletic trainer was. There's a couple of other things within the amendment, just ensuring that we are continuing to have that relationship with the physicians, as Representative Hewitt talked about. So we practice under physician licenses in current state, and that is not changing. So it just kind of strengthens the fact that we will continue to do that, and puts in some provisions such as line 3.3 through 3.10 in terms of things that we must do to make sure that we are functioning within those capacities.
Okay. Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Keeler?
My statement's on the underlying bill, if I can wait.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So Representative Hewitt has moved the A1 amendment. We see no further discussion. All those, you do on the amendment? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Representative, Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Chair Becker and Representative Hewitt. And there are some significant changes in the underlying bill with the amendment. And can you talk a little bit more? I mean, we got rid of risk management, changed it to reduction wellness, health literacy. We got rid of prevention and wellness promotion. We got rid of rehab and reconditioning. And there's a lot of pieces in the underlying bill that I'm super supportive of that got pulled out in this amendment. And I know that we had to do some things with Peace in the Valley, but it seems like these are some pretty big changes. Is that not, am I missing something?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
And for the record, state your name.
Yes, sir. Kate Tabor. To answer your question, Representative, the definition of athletic training that we have in the amendment is something that we agree to. So we feel like the language that is in that section covers what we do and what we are as athletic trainers. So we are supportive and okay with that. A lot of it was condensing and consolidating kind of some of the verbiage into words that better fit kind of what the intent is that we are doing as athletic trainers.
My follow-up.
Yeah, and thank you. My final question is, immediate and emergency care was pulled in the amendment. And, I mean, I was an athlete in high school and college, and there was, dislocated shoulders in my world, and I looked at that as immediate and emergency care. And does that mean that athletic trainers, how would that scenario, if I dislocate my shoulder, or a student athlete dislocates their shoulder, what can the athletic trainer do in that instance?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Kate Tabor. Thank you. That is a great question. In line 1.13, it talks about how athletic training for the purpose of treating emergent acute. So those two words really help qualify kind of the situation that you are talking about. So if an athlete, if a patient, right, dislocates their shoulder, that we have the ability to do that. If you also go down to line 1.18, critical incident management, that is another area in which that covers those areas, so that we will continue to be able to do those things that we're educated and trained to do within the context of that acute injury management.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We're going to take a vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor by adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Today, we do have two testifiers. First one that we have is a Troy Hogan.
Hain.
What's that?
Hain.
Hain, thank you. Appreciate that. You have a minute and a half and state your name and go ahead with your words.
Thank you, Chair members. For the record, my name is Troy Hain. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association in support of House File 82. We are healthcare professionals educated across the spectrum of care, ranging from prevention, emergency management, diagnosis, treatment, rehabilitation, and return to activity of acute and chronic orthopedic and non-orthopedic conditions. My athletic training education has prepared me to treat patients across the lifespan in emergency situations, including a life-threatening event on September 3rd of 2021. Near the end of the opening game of football season, the Waseca head football coach collapsed just feet in front of me. I rushed to his side to begin the primary assessment when it was evident he was not breathing normally and his heart was not beating. The athletic trainer from the opposing sideline also came over with the AED, which provided a shock, and within 2 to 3 minutes, that patient was conscious and alert before the ambulance got there and was able to be, saved in that situation. Just 1 week after that, another athletic trainer saved a color guard member prior to a football game. Even though we've been trained to treat physically active people across the lifespan, technically under our statute, neither the coach or that color guard member's lives that were saved would meet the definition of an athlete.
30-second warning.
The outdated terminology continues to limit patient access to athletic trainers. Minnesota is only one of 8 states that still defines our patient or our scope as athlete. All the rest of them have moved to new terminology. Our practice act has not been updated in 30 years. The minimum education required today is a master's degree from an accredited program. We no longer work just in secondary schools. You find us in clinics, companies like Amazon and Delta, and even the Minnesota Department of Corrections hires athletic trainers. We've consulted with the Board of Medical Practice, who takes a neutral position on the proposed bill regarding the ability to regulate us. And in your packets, you'll find letters of support regarding this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hain. We have Dr. Olson. You are on deck. Is Olson on Zoom, or is he in?
I believe he's on Zoom.
Okay. Dr. Olson, you're on Zoom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dr. David Olson. I'm a board-certified family medicine and sports medicine physician. I'm a team doc with the University of Minnesota here in Chicago now with Gophers basketball, Minnesota Vikings, the Twins, St. Thomas, and U.S. soccer. And I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association and also in strong support of HF 82. In Minnesota and in my practice, athletic trainers and physicians work in collaboration to establish our protocols and treatment plans. All of the athletic trainers, like Kate talked about, work and practice under the physician's licensure. And our partnership with athletic trainers that we work with is vital to patient care in everything we do. Our athletic trainers are educated and board certified in many different settings, like in our physician clinics. And it's really been proven to improve patient care and allow for greater clinical efficiency for us docs. We trust them to take care of our million-dollar athletes while we're on the court, field, or ice. But I understand right now current law prevents them from taking care of the same individuals if they suffer an injury outside of their sport. Our athletic trainers definitely have the skill set and knowledge to evaluate and treat individuals in the clinics as well. And really, for all of us, our neighbors, you, your families, and the Minnesota people really deserve to have access to these athletic trainers because they are highly skilled healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. Really, for everything I do, athletic trainers help in my clinics provide strong coverage for athletic programs. And I really think this change is good for us as physicians, but also for our patients, employers, and really for the good of healthcare workforce in Minnesota as a whole. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. Is there anyone in the audience who wished to testify on House File 82? Okay. I'm not aware of any other amendments. We do have Representative Keeler. You had a question about the bill. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for carrying the bill. But more than that, I want to say thank you to Rhonda. She's in the room, and this is a bill that I've been hearing a lot about because MSUM students have come to talk to me about this for a couple years now. I was also a college athlete. I'm glad Representative Nadeau asked about those questions in the emergency response. My son suffered a really traumatic concussion in football in high school, and he instantly turned from an athlete to a patient. And I am forever grateful for how quick people were able to move. He plays college football now, and I had a conversation with him about this bill and like how our student athletes view you all and the work that you do. And it very much is compassion and care when they're in some of their most tragic moments as an athlete. And so I appreciate the changes. But more than that, just want to give a shout out to my MSUM students who have made the trips down here. We know that's not close to really advocate for the changes in that. And so I'm in strong support of it because I believe when our communities and the future of the profession come and ask us for changes, we should listen and we should support that. So thank you.
Yes, and just like Representative Keeler, I had the opportunity to talk to the folks from MSU also. So back in Fergus, we met in Fergus Falls. So Chair Liebling, you have a question, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I have no doubt that athletic trainers are very revered in the sphere of athletics. There's no question about that. What the bill does, though, is broaden their scope, and I do have some concerns about it. So a couple of questions. The first one is, you know, the non-orthopedic conditions. What could you just give me some examples of what non-orthopedic conditions an athletic trainer would be working with under the bill?
Go ahead.
Kate Tabor, thank you, Representative. Non-orthopedic conditions, there are different things, as Representative Keeler discussed, concussions, working with asthma, heat illnesses, cardiac events. Those are all within kind of that realm of non-orthopedic injuries.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That helps. And then the other thing is in the bill, I think this is newly added. Well, it was in the underlying bill as well, but on line 1.17, it adds to the scope assessment, evaluation, and diagnosis. So I don't know if diagnosis is defined in statute anywhere, but diagnosis is not something that I would associate with athletic trainers, and I wonder if you could discuss that a little bit. And actually, let me ask a nonpartisan staff, first of all, whether diagnosis has a definition in statute, if Ms. Clarkvist can help me with that, or Ms. Mock, I don't know.
Which, you guys are both looking at each other, so whoever gets heads, okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm not aware of a definition of diagnosis.
Okay, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So. So that, you know, that's a big concern because, you know, I know it's like everybody in the scope of practice world, a lot of times it's like, well, we know it when we see it. We know our scope of practice when we see it, and we won't go outside of it. But the language of the statute really matters. And so maybe you could, if you can address my question, what is diagnosis here that now athletic trainers would be able to do under the bill?
Yeah, Ms. Steberg, I think I got that right.
Yes.
Oh, thank good. You. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Kate Tabor, thank you for the question. So in many of our conversations with the physicians and chiropractors and physical therapists, that was definitely a discussion point. And line 1.14 and 1.15, it states, you know, that athletic training is performed within the professional training and experience provided by our approved education program and included within the athletic training credentialing exam. And then the next five lines are the different things that fall within that. As I mentioned earlier, this language comes directly from the Board of Certification, which is the group that provides the credentialing examination for us. And so this is the technical language that they used and has been adopted nationally to state this is what athletic training does. So it's diagnosis within the training of what we do. And then the second part is that we are practicing under physician's licensure. So everything that we do, we are under, as Dr. Olson described, we are functioning under their licensure. So we each have supervising physicians that we work with that we collaborate with, and anything that we do is under kind of their guidance and under their purview and under their licensure as well.
Representative Hewitt.
Chair Backer and Rep. Liebling. This is common, actually, if you get to the underlevel of physician group. We have, like, EMT diagnosis, but that diagnosis stays with us to report to the doctor. Mm-hmm. It's nothing we can use on a chart or anything like that's going right like to insurance or for fraud or anything like that. We're real careful on that one. So it's a, like, we have nursing diagnoses. There's all sorts of things, but this is like in their realm. They can say to the doctor, I think it's this, and then the doctor has to reexamine and prove that. So it's helped with treatment, but I'm sorry to be an insider here, but the truth is we've been using this in nursing, we've been using it in EMS, we've been using it in, I'm trying to think, there's several places where we have, like, the technical or, like, the people that actually do the work use this kind of medicine.
Follow up, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thanks for that, Representative Hewitt. I mean, in this line, it says assessment, evaluation, and diagnosis. So those have to be three different things. They're three different things. So diagnosis has to be different than assessment.
They are.
And evaluation. So I'm still trying to get the answer.
No, and it,
what
I,
does it mean
Representative
to do
Hewitt.
A diagnosis under
right.
this amendment?
They are three separate. You do an assessment. You do an evaluation. Where is the other one? So I get it right. This is a typical. In diagnosis, it's like, what's your opinion? Do you think this is a fracture or do you think it's a bruise? From my assessment, the patient wasn't moving. I think that there was little, you know, I'd have to see the patient. I'm sorry, I'm not as educated as they are. So I do you understand that there that it's a process that they have to go through when they're it's the process any of us have to go through when we're not a doctor.
Mr. Chair, if I could just
yes, go
finish
ahead.
Up here. And thanks for that, Representative Hewitt. You know, that's the problem. I'm struggling with this because it is a scope expansion. And I feel like there isn't a guardrail here because that word, I still haven't gotten, and I'm not going to keep pushing on. You know, it's kind of a we know it when we see it. And the problem is it all depends here on within professional training and experience provided by an approved education program and included in the athletic trainer credentialing, which basically means that the profession is going to from here in totally define what it is. And if we start teaching you how to do read EKGs, then that's going to be within your scope because you'll know how to do it because of training or something like that. I mean, I don't know what it would be, but I just, you know, and I do want to say about the practicing under the auspices of a physician. I think that's all good. That does give us some comfort. However, how many times have we seen here that then the profession has that, then they're like, well, this is meaningless supervision. We don't really need this. We know what we're doing. That has happened with so many professions, and that's a slippery slope thing. I know that's not really before us today, but I just, if we're going to do this and give this expansion and say it's not just about athletes, it's about patients, I think we need to at least understand what a diagnosis is. I mean, you know, that they're now allowed to do, and you define diagnosis by referring to assessment. It's got to be something different, and I'm just not comfortable with it. It's okay. I don't want to use all your time trying to define diagnosis, but just saying this is why I'm not comfortable with the bill. Thank you.
We're going to go to Representative Gilman. She's going to have the final comment, and then we're going to take a vote, folks. Go ahead, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill. Again, I've got student athletes, and I love the letters of support even from our local high schools. With sports, injuries happening and different things happening, but we've also seen an official go down and have a massive heart episode. And they were there, and we swiftly responded with getting the necessary things, getting to the right door so we could, so there was a life saved. And so, and I've also seen young students be inspired to go into that field, especially when they've suffered an ACL injury, or like for them it was, you know, a season-ending injury happened, but the way they were treated swiftly and then the processes that they were referred on to physical therapy, and there's a care team model. So I love that we're able to bring things like this forward, and because there's more athletic trainers in our schools and all around and in college, I'm very supportive of this. So thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Hewitt, the final words.
Thank you, committee, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for the robust and very good questions, and I understand where you're at. Representative Gilman just summed it up for us, though, is like, as an EMT, I don't know what a torn tendon is. I know I can stabilize it. I can put them in my ambulance and bring them to these guys who can, well, the doctors and people like that, and they can treat them. So we all have our roles, right? And I'm glad that we finally got this here. I'm hoping that with your support, we were able to pass this on. And, Mr. Chair, where are you signing it?
We're going to General Register.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Yeah, we're going.
Well, I'm ready for it.
We're going to the big football field, okay? There we go. Okay. Well, Representative Hewitt moves that House File 82, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
The motion does prevail. House File 82, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Thank you, members. We now have House File 2689, Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer. Our goal is to vote on this at 2:04. That's our goal. So that is our fourth bill we have consideration today. Representative Ryer, would you like to move House File 2689 to get in before the committee?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay, what's this? Okay, Representative Ryer moves that House File 2689 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Judicial Finance and Civil Law. We have the bill before us. Can you please share us about the bill?
Thank you, Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, members. For more than 45 years, Minnesotans have been able to access physical therapy directly. Yet there are still unnecessary barriers to this access, including a 90-day limit on care without a physician referral, extra appointments, and confusing rules for newly licensed physical therapists. These obstacles don't improve care. They can slow recovery, increase costs, and sometimes lead to more expensive treatments. House File 2689 addresses these outdated restrictions by modifying the physical therapy practice governing provisions. The bill removes the 90-day referral requirement, allowing patients to continue care without interruption. It modernizes the statute to reflect the education, training, and licensing standards of doctors of physical therapy. It also clarifies how physical therapists and physical therapist assistants collaborate to deliver safe and efficient care. Additionally, it strengthens title and term protection and gives the Board of Physical Therapy authority to enforce the rules and issue fines when necessary. Importantly, this bill does not expand the scope of practice. Physical therapists' roles have been well-defined for decades, and their duty to refer patients whose conditions fall outside their scope remains unchanged. Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, the A2. Shall I speak to that now as well?
Yes. Yes, go ahead, because we are moving that amendment labeled A2. Speak to that amendment, please.
Thank you. So the author's amendment makes clarifications taken in part from stakeholders. And when I say stakeholders, there have been many, many conversations to refine this bill, work through points that weren't clear and that were problematic for others in various professions. So it was a carefully crafted amendment. It clarifies and reorganizes the physical therapist assistant supervision requirements. It strengthens term and title protections for PTAs, the physical therapy assistants, and physical therapy, and it removes physiotherapy, which was a pain point for one of our stakeholders. It adds athletic trainers as providers whose practice is not considered physical therapy. It restores the failure to refer requirement for PTs to refer a patient to the appropriate health provider if the patient is not progressing, and it updates student supervision from on-site to direct supervision. And, Mr. Chair, that is the A2.
Thank you. Further discussion, further discussion on the A2. Okay, seeing none, Representative Ryer has moved Amendment A2. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, that motion prevails. The amendment is as adopted. Today we have a hearing of five testifiers on House File 2689. You are limited to 90 seconds. And the first on deck is Professor Holly Clinch. Thank you. Go ahead. State your name and go for it.
I am Holly Clinch. I've been a licensed PT for 42 years and a professor of physical therapy at St. Catherine University for 28 years. And I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2689. PTs have been providing care in Minnesota since the 1950s. We are more prepared than ever to deliver care via direct access. All PT programs in the United States, including Minnesota's programs, are required to be delivered at the post-baccalaureate doctoral level with a minimum of 96 weeks of education, including a clinical portion of at least 30 weeks. Let me be clear. We do not make a medical diagnosis. We make a physical therapy diagnosis. In fact, we are required to do so by Medicare and other third-party payers. So what does that mean? Every physical therapy initial evaluation includes a review of the patient's medical history and screening for red flags, followed by tests and measures to assess the patient's functional status. We determine the impact of physical impairments, things such as decreased strength, pain, or impaired balance, on the patient's ability to move as desired, and we treat those impairments via PT. Referrals are made for conditions requiring care outside of PT or requiring consultation prior to PT. Our Code of Ethics and our Practice Act requires us to deliver care within our professional and jurisdictional boundaries. Our proposed bill does not change this, nor does it expand our scope of practice. It merely eliminates barriers for our patients who access our services. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Forrest Agnes Beck, and then on deck is Lori Stead. So, Forrest?
Yeah. Forrest Andrews Beck.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, and members of the House Health Committee. My name is Dr. Forrest Andrews Beck, Doctor of Physical Therapy and Board Certified Clinical Specialist in Orthopedics. I'm asking you today to support House File 2689. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm speaking in support of this, of the change to the Physical Therapy Practice Act. As a physical therapist, I spent my morning seeing patients and I'm taking this afternoon to ask you to support removing the remaining barriers for direct access to physical therapy. 21 states, including three of Minnesota's neighbors, allow full direct access. Malpractice insurance rates are not increased for these states, as there is no how there has been found to be no increased risk of patient harm or increased risk, legal risk for physical therapists in states with direct access. Physical therapists receive extensive training to identify red flags,
30-second warning,
signs and symptoms, and are required to make referrals to other healthcare providers when something is outside our scope of practice. Something that I do regularly in my practice and have helped to identify serious medical conditions such as cancer, strokes, and deep vein thromboses through these referrals. Last year, I ran into a case where a student athlete came in. They were experiencing, and I hope you support.
Okay, thank you, there. We have Lauren Steed, I think that's pronounced, and then after that is on deck is Lisa Mattson. Please state your name.
Hi, Jane. It's Dr. Lauren Steed. I'm a committee member here.
Oh, if you, sit in front of the mic there, please. Thank you.
Hello, my friends. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Lauren Steed. I am board certified podiatrist and foot and ankle surgeon practicing in Rochester, Minnesota for the last 44 years. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Podiatric Medical Association, which represents the podiatric physicians and surgeons across Minnesota. We respectfully oppose House File 2689. The bill makes sweeping changes to the physical therapy practice in Minnesota. It expands the scope by granting physical therapists diagnostic authority while simultaneously removing important medical oversight protections. Specifically, the bill eliminates the requirement that the patients receive a medical diagnosis before beginning physical therapy, removes the current 90-day treatment limitation, and removes the supervised practice requirements for newly licensed therapists. Physical therapists are valuable members of our health care team.
30-second warning.
However, they are not trained to make medical diagnosis. Their education focuses on rehabilitation, functional assessment. They cannot order images such as MRIs, CAT scans, or x-rays. They cannot prescribe medication. A physical therapy evaluation is not the same as a medical diagnosis. The distinction matters for patient safety. Our members already see situations where physical therapists operate beyond their current scope, managing postoperative wounds and infections, disregarding surgeon care plans. For these reasons, the Podiatric Medical Association respectfully ask the committee to oppose House File 2689. Thank you for your time and consideration in this important matter, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Okay, Lisa Mattson, and then on Zoom, which will be on deck, will be Dr. Paul Laffey. Okay, Lisa.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Lisa Mattson, and I have the honor to serve as president of the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in respectful opposition to House File 2689. Physicians value the important work of PTs. We work closely with them, and physical therapy plays a critical role in helping patients recover from injury, surgery, and chronic conditions. Under current Minnesota statute, patients are able to access physical therapy directly without a referral. However, the law includes an important guardrail. A physical therapist may treat a patient without a referral for up to 90 days, which is 3 months. But if that patient is not improving and treatment needs to continue beyond that point, the patient must receive an order or referral from a physician. Persistent musculoskeletal symptoms can sometimes be the first sign of a more serious underlying condition, such as an infection, neurologic disease, or a systemic illness, or in the case of children, a developmental disorder. These are best evaluated by a
30-second warning.
House File 2689 would remove this safeguard by eliminating the requirement for a referral after the initial 90-day period. The bill also expands the definition of physical therapy to include diagnosis other than medical diagnosis, and it's not clear what that means. The term diagnosis itself is not clearly defined in statute. Introducing this language without clear boundaries creates potential confusion about roles and responsibilities. Finally, current law includes additional safeguards for physical therapists in their first year of practice, recognizing that early clinical experience benefits from additional collaboration and oversight by a physician, For these reasons, the Minnesota Medical Association urges the committee to oppose House File 2689. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Paul Lafferty, you're on Zoom.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Paul Lafferty. I'm an orthopedic surgeon with 18 years experience specializing in trauma and adult reconstruction. I'm here to testify respectfully in opposition to House File 2689 on behalf of the Minnesota Orthopedic Society. I echo all of the concerns that were previously raised. I've also seen firsthand how serious medical conditions can masquerade as routine musculoskeletal pain. With missed or delayed diagnosis, it can have devastating short and long-term consequences for patients. I recently treated a 90-year-old gentleman whose case illustrates our concerns very clearly. He had a stress fracture of his femur due to long-term bisphosphonate use, a rare condition well known to orthopedic surgeons such as myself, but not necessarily to physical therapists, and the fracture was in imminent danger of becoming complete. He was being treated with extensive PT for hip pain prior to being seen by me. His son ultimately decided to bring him in on his own accord to be evaluated, and after a thorough history, physical examination, and plain x-rays, I diagnosed the impending fracture and was quickly able to perform the needed surgery. I've also seen many simpler instances.
30-second warning.
Thank you. Were inappropriately being treated with physical therapy and ultimately got the appropriate treatment once I was able to engage the patient. I hope you can see how this can lead to delayed or inaccurate diagnosis. Patients deserve a care model that prioritizes a physician-led patient care team, and I again reiterate the opposition of the Minnesota Orthopedic Society to House File 2689. Thank you.
Thank you, testifiers. Also, members, there are written testimony in your packet. You'll find them in your packet on online. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2689? Okay, members, discussion. I think we have Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Backer. And physical therapist, I don't know which one of you want to answer, but both of you should come up. Or I have a quick question for you. Obviously, you both have good clinical backgrounds. When you have a patient that is exhibiting some sort of reason to get an MRI or an X-ray, what do you do?
Ms. Clinch, go ahead.
It probably depends in what setting you're in. If you're in a private practice, you would probably contact the physician directly. If you're in a skilled nursing facility where I spent a lot of my clinical practice, you might go through the nurse or you might call the doctor directly. You may request, you know, something that, you know, depending on the situation, you may ask, you know, could the patient be sent for an MRI or an X-ray or something like that. Sometimes we've asked for blood work to confirm if maybe a patient has anemia or something like that. We don't try to diagnose it, but we will talk to the doctor and share the signs and symptoms that we're seeing and the response to therapy.
Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up.
Yep, go ahead.
So obviously what you're seeing in both these bills today are people that work in the healthcare continuum. And it's so important, I was a part of it at one time, that we understand that medicine has changed, access has changed, scopes are changing, but you're still hearing how we work together collaboratively. As you heard the physical therapist just say, I'm going to call the physician. If not, I'll work through the other nurses or whoever I have to do if I think that we have to look further. She did not say she's going to order it. She is not saying that she could order it. She just said, I'm going to make that recommendation. And I understand we have another turf territory here, but I think holding them back from what they really are skilled to do, how the patients relate to the physical therapist, I think that would be a mistake. So there's my two cents.
Okay, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill. I am a co-author on this bill. I did have a lot of feedback in district, and a couple of things that one of the physical therapists pointed out to me is that these provisions in this bill do not restrict a patient from seeking a physician referral. And as we know with insurance and different things that are happening in people's lives, a lot of times they have to go through physical therapy and they have to do things to move their bodies to be well before they can even go beyond that if there's more things to go. And what I'm excited about is that this will make life more affordable for Minnesotans. This bill will save patients money and the state money by removing unnecessary, you know, hiccups in their waits to get in with physicians and any lagging time. So I'm very happy that this is moving forward and excited to keep working on this. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gilman. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I wanted to ask, where are you sending this bill?
This is going to Judicial, Finance, and Civil Law.
Okay, yep, it is. I just wanted to check.
Thank you for asking.
It needs to go there.
It's going to your committee, Chair.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, one of them. So, this bill has come back in different forms a number of times. And, you know, I appreciate PTs. You know, I've had physical therapy. I think many of us have. And, you know, they do terrific work, and they're a great profession. But I really, and I appreciate, you know, I had not actually talked to the MMA people about the definition of diagnosis or any of that. They came upon that separately from me, and I'm glad you addressed that in your remarks, that it's different than medical diagnosis, and at least in this, it says that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the previous bill, it didn't say that. It just said diagnosis. But, you know, I do have a concern. It doesn't seem to me that having somebody who comes out of school operate under referrals is such a burden for one year, and then they're done for the rest of their career. That seems to me really pretty modest ask to make sure that we are, you know, that people understand how to work with physicians and understand all of that and get that extra bit of experience before they then can go off completely on their own. And when you couple that with wanting to remove the 90-day requirement, that really gives me heartburn, because then you've got somebody just out of school, and I know you said they do the clinical practice and all that, but they're still newly on their own, and now suddenly they can see a patient and see them forever without ever referring them, even if they're not getting better. And those two things together, I think, are a really bad recipe. And I know that most of the time, and this is true of, you know, all of our wonderful practitioners, most of the time they're fine. We write these rules for the people where it isn't fine. And those, of course, are a minority of their practitioners. And most, you know, honestly, I don't know that most PTs will ever be impacted. Even if this bill passes or doesn't pass, most PTs are probably not going to experience much difference other than those coming right out of school. But, you know, I really feel that what's in law right now is an important safeguard. And I just don't think that this is a good idea to just remove this and... you know, for the person whose cancer is missed, whose stress fracture is missed. I mean, those are really serious impacts that even if those don't occur a lot, if they can be prevented by what I think is a very reasonable 90-day period of time to try to treat somebody with PT, and if they're not getting better, have them go make sure that they don't have something else. I don't really view that as being unreasonable the way the law is written, so I'm going to be opposed to the bill.
Sure, thank you. 30-second comment on that, then we're going to go to Representative Nadeau, and we will then take a vote.
Holly Clinch, I would say that it is an issue in the rural setting and some underserved settings where PTs may be working as the only PT in a clinic. So if somebody does want to access services via direct access, but that's the only PT who's working there, they either have to travel to a further distance or they do have to get a doctor's visit before they can proceed through the normal chain of command. I would also say that new graduates, probably more than anyone, are going to be likely to refer before 90 days if they see anything that's out of the ordinary. We really teach students and graduates to operate on the side of caution, and it's always good to get a second opinion. So safety and effectiveness is always our primary concern.
Okay, Representative Nadeau, final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And Representative Lee, I have similar concerns, and I support the bill, but I have similar concerns with Representative Liebling, and we're going to see this in an next coming bill as well, where we're getting rid of this practice in training. And I'm wondering, my question is, I doubt there's any evidence to suggest that it's unnecessary, and I think there's probably a lot of evidence to suggest that even highly trained practitioners coming out of higher educational requirements than we've ever had before are able to, you know, are able to perform. But there's a huge difference that I've learned in delivering techniques that are taught and providing long-term established healthcare outcomes. And I think that's the thing that I worry about that we're giving up, as it seems like so many of these licensing bills now are moving away from this practice and training. And I'm concerned. I think people are concerned with this. And so as you move forward in judiciary, I hope you address that in a specific way to kind of make us feel safer in that. I mean, again, we talk about scope bills all the time. We're the last people that should be deciding on your scope of practice. But here we are. So I would only suggest that you spend some time doing that and saying that access in greater Minnesota, that's not a reason for me. To me, that's a lesser trained person in greater Minnesota. And so be able to, you know, maybe think about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Ryer, final words for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to everyone with the comments and testimony. I want to point out that I've done very deep literature reviews on this and looked diligently for negative outcomes from open access to physical therapy. And instead, I find high referral accuracy, less imaging drugs referral to specialists unnecessarily, equal on outcomes and safety, superior in patient satisfaction, and economics. So as a tool that is safe and has been extensively studied and helps with cost and access to care, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative Ryer moves that House File 2689, as amended, be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. House File 2689, as amended, is referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. And next, thank you, members. Our fifth bill, and our goal is to vote on this at 2:27. So the fifth bill we have to consider is House File 1794. Representative Nadeau, would you mind making a motion to move Representative Vernick's bill before the committee?
I move House File 1794, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And I think we got co-presenters here. So we have Representative Fernig and then Representative Warkas, right?
Warwas.
Thank you, sir. Okay, go. You got 3 minutes to present the bill.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, committee members. I'm super excited. Before you is House File 1794, a bipartisan bill brought forth by the Minnesota APRN Coalition, representing the majority of APRNs across the state. Supporters include the Minnesota Nurse Practitioner Association, the Minnesota Association of Nurse Anesthetists, the Minnesota Affiliate of Nurse Midwives, and the Minnesota Affiliate of National Association of Clinical Nurse Specialists. The transition to practice limits where certified nurse specialists and nurse practitioners can work for the first 2,080 hours of their career. During Minnesota's transition to practice period, CNSs and MPs must work in a hospital or integrated clinical setting where a physician is also employed. The TPT Repeal Act would remove this barrier to practice and help to solve access shortages in mental health, primary care, and especially in greater Minnesota. Not only that, it would align us with 16 other states, including our neighbors North Dakota and Iowa. APRN's education and licensure requirements prepare them for practice. With me today, I have some testifiers who can speak to the value of APRNs and why this is needed, including my colleague, Rep.
Warwas.
Good afternoon, everyone. Rep. Cal Warwas for the record. First time in Health Committee, excited to be here with you. And per tradition, I brought treats.
Oh, you did? Good.
Yes, there's a bucket of treats, and I hope that the pages will be able to pass out the bucket. There's some tongs there, so you can stay
Thank
healthy
you.
Passing those out. And they are made by my daughter, who is a renowned baker in this caucus as well. Yes. So my story and some of my interest in this bill, being from rural Minnesota, is the fact that I utilize a nurse practitioner for my health care, and I actually credit one for saving my life. It's a little bit of a long-winded story. I'll keep it short for this testimony, but because of additional testing that she ordered, not saying a doctor couldn't have also done that, but because of the work that she did, cancer was discovered on my right kidney, which I eventually lost in surgery. We tried to save that kidney. It was a large tumor, and I had my right kidney removed during the COVID era in 2020 at the Mayo Clinic. And I don't believe I would be here with you today were it not for the good work in that rural clinic. And so I'm very supportive of this bill, excited to see the opportunity for more providers to be able to get out into rural Minnesota and to not have to undergo the burden of the previous or the current statute. So I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you. We have a technical amendment labeled A1. Representative Doe, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I'll move the A1.
Okay, thank you. Please speak to that amendment, Representative Vernig or Representative Warwas.
Could I get a copy of the amendment, please?
We'll have the one in the also nonpartisan.
Yes, it's changing the date from 25 to 26. Thank you.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay. Any discussion of changing the date? I don't see none. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, those in favor of the technical A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. The amendment is as adopted. Today we have five testifiers along with written testimony in your packets, members. We have 90 seconds to ensure everybody has the opportunity to speak. Dr. Gretchen Moen, you are first, and then after that on deck, please move to the front. Dr. Brian Goodrold. Go ahead, Dr. Moen. 90 seconds, please.
Good afternoon, Chairs Backer and Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Moen, and I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner in Eagan, Minnesota. I support House File 1794. I was the founder and clinical director of Dakota Child and Family Clinic, a nurse practitioner nonprofit charity clinic in Burnsville, Minnesota, the first one in the upper Midwest. It was formulated initially in 2002. For 23 years, we provided patient-centered, integrated primary care and behavioral health services to children and adults. Nearly 64 of our patients were either uninsured or underinsured, and we were known for our unique model of care and expertise in serving individuals with neurodiversity and those with significant behavioral health issues. And we're a referral center for physicians, other nurse practitioners, community and service organizations, and healthcare systems. We trained over 200 nurse practitioners, 8 physician assistants, 30 RNs, and 16 medical assistants, with our average provider full-time equivalent of 2. Finding providers who enjoyed working with our with unique population
warning.
And limited resources is very difficult. The time and cost of training providers is high, and NP clinics cannot hire NPs they train because of transition to practice limits. The students leave to find jobs elsewhere, and it is difficult to ask them to return years later in the midst of establishing their own practice. Without providers generating revenue, even a brief merger could not keep the doors open, and the clinic closed in January of 2025. I firmly believe we would have had a different outcome if we weren't able to hire NP students we've trained. I respectfully ask you to consider voting yes on House File 1794, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Okay, next to speak is Dr. Ryan Goodrow, and then on deck is Dr. Koenig. Go ahead, Dr. Goodrow, 90 seconds, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Backer and Chair Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Brian Goodrow. I'm here today as the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, or APRN Coalition, and here to ask for your support on HF 1794. You can help remove a barrier to APRN-led care and provide needed health care services to Minnesotans. This unnecessary regulation drives new graduates to seek jobs in neighboring states and often with large health systems. This diversion undermines our smaller APRN-led clinics' ability to hire the workforce needed to provide care in the communities they serve. In fact, it was hearing from our APRN-led clinics in rural, urban, and suburban under-resourced areas that we began this process over 5 years ago. This outdated barrier is truly redundant to existing standards. Rigorous master's or doctoral education, clinical program accreditation, and national board certification exams already ensure safe entry-level competence. Additionally, most APRNs have multiple years of practice as an RN prior to preparation for their advanced role. Evidence spanning almost 60 years demonstrates the quality, safety, and cost-effectiveness of NP and CNS care. You've heard from others how this barrier restricts access to health care. Ultimately, repealing this requirement will help alleviate the state's severe shortages of primary and mental health providers by expanding access to care, particularly in Greater Minnesota. We ask for your support for HF 1794. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Kulnick, again, please state your name. You're on deck.
And she's on Zoom.
Okay, she is on Zoom. Okay, yes, you're right. My mistake. Go ahead. Go ahead, and then after that is on Zoom, Sarah McCumber. Go ahead there, Dr.
Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of bipartisan House File 1794. I'm Dr. Naomi Koenig, nurse practitioner and owner of Sela Wellness Clinic. We operate four clinics in multiple underserved counties with HPSA scores of 19 and 20. Indicating severe provider shortages. Our team provides integrative primary care, psychiatry, and substance use treatment. Despite these challenges, our depression treatment program has achieved over a 90% remission rate, and our clinics have received dozens of state and local awards for quality care. Under current law, I spend tens of thousands of dollars each year paying a physician solely to meet a statutory supervision requirement. That expense does not improve patient care. It simply satisfies an administrative mandate. Those resources could be used to recruit clinicians, expand services, or improve access to care. NP clinics already maintain strong clinical oversight through structured NP fellowship.
30-second warning.
New providers always have an experienced NP available for consult and guidance. This bill is modest and practical. There are no licensing changes. It allows NPs to supervise NPs. This bill strengthens Minnesota's healthcare workforce, supports metro and rural communities by removing unnecessary barriers so providers can focus on what matters most, delivering timely, high-quality care. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Next is Sarah McCumber, and then on deck is Dr. Lisa Matson.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah McCumber. I'm a 25-year advanced practice certified nurse practitioner and also a nurse practitioner educator. I'm testifying from the Duluth area. I am in strong support of House File 1794 to align our Minnesota practice with 16 other states and D.C. This is not a license change. APRNs provide excellent, high-quality, safe care. APRNs also hold a high standard for mentorship and collaboration in any setting that we work. Physician supervision is expensive and unnecessary. I have physicians who refer patients to me, and I refer patients to physicians. So I strongly request your support for this bill.
Thank you. And then Lisa Matson. Oh, you're up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Lisa Matson, and I have the honor of serving as president of the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 1794. Minnesota physicians value the very important role that APRNs play in the healthcare system. Physicians work closely with them every day to care for patients across a wide range of settings. I send my own daughters to see an APRN, and if I was at Mayo, I would send them to see an APRN there because they work in a physician-led team. Under current Minnesota law, newly licensed nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists complete at least 2,080 hours of practice under a collaborative agreement with a physician. This period allows new clinicians to transition into independent practice with structured mentorship and support while caring for patients within a team-based environment. One's definition of normal is based on their understanding of abnormal. That's why doctors go to medical school for 4 years and do residency for 3 to 8 years, so we can see enough abnormals to differentiate between them.
House File 1794 would take away an additional year of supervision and interfere with APRN's abilities to hone their skills. They run the risk of missing abnormal things and also of calling normal things abnormal, resulting in unnecessary testing, unnecessary procedures, and increased patient stress. It is also true in medicine that the more you learn, the more you appreciate how much you don't know. And when we don't realize what we don't know, we all become dangerous. Changes to scope of practice laws should be carefully evaluated to ensure training, oversight, and team-based care structures. I strongly encourage you to oppose House File 1794. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1794? Okay, clarification, this would move to the general register. I don't think I was clear with that at the beginning. I'm not aware of any other amendments. We have discussion, and we have Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Vernick, for bringing this bill, and also you, just the people that are on it. This question, I think, is for Dr. Naomi, is it Koenig, I believe, who is on Zoom, if she's available? I just had a couple questions for her because she talked about the rural aspect of it. Is she available?
Dr. Koenig, are you available?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Gilman, with your question.
So thank you for your testimony. Would removing this requirement allow you to open additional clinics and expand services in underserved areas?
Go ahead, Doctor.
Thank you so much. It would. Rural communities, as well as suburban communities, often struggle to recruit and retain physicians. Nurse practitioners are more likely to practice in underserved areas, as evidenced by Sela Wellness Clinic operating within three different rural underserved communities. Experienced NPs love mentoring and supervising other NPs, helping to stabilize the communities in which we serve. I currently have multiple different students that I train and teach that reach out to me over their entire lifetime of practice. So it's that relationship building of collaboration of care. By expanding and allowing to open additional clinics, we can improve continuity of care in communities where providers are scarce, removing barriers, not preserving barriers.
Okay, Representative Gilman?
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Chair Liebling, go ahead.
So I would like to offer a little bit of history on this. We've been getting emails, I think, from the APRN Coalition that say something like, this outdated regulation's been there for decades. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's, I think, 12 years old, not decades. And it was put in place for a reason. And so in 2014, I believe it was, at that time, APRNs practiced under an agreement with a physician. Every single one of them was supposed to be under a collaborative agreement, just like we just talked about with the athletic trainers. And they found that burdensome, and it, you know, they made an argument, which was a good one, that a lot of times those agreements were just in form but really meaningless, that it just involved having a contract with a physician who never really supervised them anyway. And they made the very same arguments about access and rural access and all of that. And what you see in the statute now represents a compromise that reflected the concern that nurse practitioners would go off and never have contact with physicians and not have the learning that comes from, as one testifier said here, knowing what they don't know. And so I think they're fine and they've done very well, and you know, I think they're a wonderful part of our healthcare ecosystem. But what you have in law right now, again, is just, I view it as a modest sort of additional reassurance that when they are going to go into a lifetime of their practice, that they go into it having had some experience in a collaborative setting with physicians. Now, I saw in one of these pieces of paper that we are given, one of these advocacy pieces, that there's cost to that. That's something I wasn't aware of. I mean, I recognize there might be tweaks that need to be made to this. But to me, just simply removing the requirement one of our testifiers here today said, NPs supervise NPs. Well, you know, that's all well and good, but physicians have a different kind of education, and they have a different perspective. And maybe many of these people have been nurses before and have worked in an integrated setting, but some have not. And so to just say, it's fine, go into practice the rest of your practice life and never have worked, possibly, in a collaborative setting with physicians where you understand who does what and what, so you get a little sense of what you might not know, I view that as a patient safety issue. And so I, you know, Representative Vernick, this bill's been here many times in the intervening years. I just want you to know that I wish we'd talked about it before, but, you know, this has been around a lot, and I don't think it's right now. I don't think it was right before, but that is not to say that there aren't things that could be tweaked. If people are having to pay for some kind of thing or, you know, it's the first time I've kind of heard about some of that, but the idea that you don't need ever to work with physicians and you can just go into your nurse practitioner practice and never really have had that experience of working in a collaborative system, because that's the way healthcare is going. You know, not hang up your shingle and be a sole practitioner in a rural place anymore. You're connected to others, whether it's telemedicine, whether it's being part of a system, and you should at least understand how the different functions work and have some broader experience. So that's why I'm opposed to the bill.
Okay.
Representative Vernick.
Thank you. We're going to Representative Vice Chair Ryer will have a question, and then Representative Rapisky, and then we're going to take a vote. So Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Vernick, for bringing this bill. You know, once a researcher, always a researcher. So I went looking for data on whether or not we were putting people at risk by having this full practice authority. And I have found many studies, one of which I'll quote, which is in the Journal of Health Economics, where I quote, I find full practice authority reduces avoidable hospitalizations for diabetes and other chronic conditions, hospital stays for, oh, I'm sorry, that's not where I meant to be. These results indicate that full practice authority improves access to outpatient care and allows for more efficient use of inpatient resources. Also, the American Academy of Family Physicians, in an article on the Resource Center, commented that while opponents of the relaxed scope of practice laws cite concerns about patient safety and the less education than physicians, evidence does not show that nurse practitioner-provided care is unsafe for patients, and the findings suggest that allowing NPs to practice without physician oversight could reduce healthcare spending without harming patients. I did look at many studies. These aren't just two that happened to say that, and, you know, not just cherry-picked results, just for the record. And I understand, to me, patient safety is the key. But I think it's also looking at the data on how things are working. One of these studies took the 22 states that had full access and compared results to all of the states like ours that do not, and found no difference or better outcomes for the open practice in a number of ways. Thank you.
Representative Rapisky.
Thank you, Chair Backer. In the interest of time for the next very important bill, I'll be quick and precise. My question is for Representative Warwas. Is it okay if I have another cookie?
You can add two more cookies, Representative.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we do have Representative Van Buren, because that was not a serious question, so go ahead. Go ahead, Representative Van Buren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank both of you for bringing this bill today. I think it's a great step. You know, as we have, especially out in the rural area, we have such a labor shortage. And I'm just excited that you're bringing this forward. I guess my question is in regards to, you think we're going to see more nurses and more people enter the field because of this? And is there any study, any information that you can address for us? Thank you.
Go, one of you, 30 seconds.
Yeah, there is some anecdotal evidence. You know, I'm an NP educator as well. That certainly when you NPs will, nurses who want to become NPs will go towards states that have full practice authority and the least amount of barriers upon them to go where they want to go and provide care when they graduate. So we have evidence of people who have moved to other states and clinics that APRNs who have started clinics in other states because of this barrier.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, and that is exactly what I had suspected. So thank you.
Okay, one of you two, not both, get to say final words. So Representative Vernig or Representative Warross, which one wanted to give the final 30 seconds?
Hey, this is a great bill. I appreciate your time today, everyone. And I do think this would help rural Minnesota in practice. You know, our providers out there, I'm hearing it's harder to get people. For one thing, if they have to move out of an area, they get settled, they get a lease, maybe they start a new relationship, get a puppy, you know, whatever. You move out of an area sometimes to get training, and sometimes you don't come back. And so I think, you know, an Iron Range story is, for me, a story of coming back to where you came from, and I think there's a lot more opportunity for providers coming from a rural area and coming back home again and not having to leave so much. So I think it's a good bill. I hope you consider the measure and vote for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nadeau moves that the House file 1794, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
No.
Nay. Okay. The motion does prevail. And House File 1794, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Our sixth bill that we have here, which our goal is to vote on this at 238, is Representative Rapisky. Would you like to move House File 3544 to get it before the committee?
Yes, I would, Chair.
Okay. We have a bill before us. Representative Rapisky, tell us about your bill, please.
House File 3544 is a Department of Veteran Affairs housekeeping and federal conformity bill. It cleans up sections of several of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs chapters of law and adds provisions to ensure federal conformity. The bill allows for the reclassification of the current chief of staff position to deputy commissioner of administration. The bill also cleans up outdated statutes and ensures the MDVA funds and programs are channeled towards eligible individuals who have not forfeited their rights to federal benefits. And Chair Backer, I would have an amendment code A1 to clarify the forfeiture of benefits are strictly veterans benefits and the veterans chapters of statute.
So we have an amendment labeled A1. You spoke to that. Is there any questions from the members about the A1 amendment? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Could you give me some examples of what the veterans benefits that could possibly be forfeited be? At this? Yeah. Thanks.
Representative Rapisky, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. At this time, I'll turn the mic over to testifier John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for MDVA. So we're looking to align with the federal forfeiture, so all of our enumerated benefits in statute would only be eligible to those who have not forfeited their federal VA benefits. So take your pick in Chapter 197 and 198. So burial in a state veteran cemetery, state soldier assistance program, admittance to a state veteran's home, all of those we are seeking to align with the federal government. And if you forfeit, and again, forfeiting your federal benefits under chapters, the list of offenses in Chapter 61, we're talking about violations of the Atomic Energy Act, treason. These are like high crimes. There's a high bar to clear for this. So, but we feel like if you've been forfeiting your federal benefits in a time of tight fiscal resources, we want to make sure that state veterans' benefits are going to those who served honorably and haven't been convicted of high crimes under Chapter 6138 Code of Federal Regulations. Okay.
Okay. Representative Bonner, do you have a question to the amendment or to the bill?
Kind of both.
Okay, go ahead with the kind of both question.
So I'm just curious, when we say this, and I understand and appreciate the explanation, but when we say forfeit, do we mean if, like you listed off, admittance to a registered veterans home, for example, or a burial? Are we talking about you have to have forfeited as the result of a crime, or are we talking about someone has decided that they do not wish to be admitted to a veterans home? They do not wish to be buried in a funeral plot, and so that now makes them ineligible in other ways? That's the part that's not entirely clear to me on this bill.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so no one's, there's not a voluntary forfeiture. If an individual has committed a crime under the list of offenses in Chapter 61 of federal law, they forfeit their federal VA benefits. It's a cause and effect. If we, and we will be implementing, if this was to become law, a regular cadence of updates with the federal VA so that we know who these folks are. And so no, if this is not about choosing to not have benefits, this is the federal government, after a conviction, has, you no longer have the ability to receive federal VA benefits, you would also be forfeiting state benefits. This is us aligning with the feds. If you are ineligible for VA benefits, you'd be ineligible for MDVA benefits. But it's not a voluntary thing. It would be after a conviction in a court of law.
Okay. Members, I do like to take a vote on the A1 amendment, if there's no objection to that. So hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment motion passed, prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there a further discussion on House File 3544? Chair Liebling.
Thank you. I just realized that there's a big repealer in this bill, and I wonder if you could just speak to that for a moment, why we're repealing this section.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair. And if it's okay with the committee, I could do my prepared remarks that covers this.
Go ahead.
So, and I'll just speak to Representative Liebling's question. I know it's been a long hearing. So the part of our housekeeping bill, we were asked to, the governor had all, you know, across the enterprise agencies going through outdated, find outdated statutes and have cleanup to our statute. So the repealer here that is why I'm, you know, here today is to repeal the Environmental Hazards and Information Act. This was a law that was passed in 1984. When the devastating effects of Agent Orange and other chemical agents in our veterans population were going through the community. Subsequently, through the federal government taking and Congress taking action in the more than 40 years since this became state law, there have been numerous pieces of legislation. So the Agent Orange Act of 1991, the Blue Water Navy Act of 2019, and the PACT Act of 2022 all now recognize widely these illnesses that are linked to environmental hazards. And the MDVA's position that was effectuating this law has not been filled since 2001, because this is a widely known presumption that continues to be updated by the federal government. In 196.24, there are duties for the Commissioner of Health, and that is why we're here today. So this is, even though it's in 196, which is one of the three chapters of law relating to the Veterans Affairs Department, it mentions the Commissioner of Health. Just so similar to the department no longer taking on this work at the state level due to the changes in recognition by the Congress and the federal VA, the same as for the Minnesota Department of Health. So these duties under information health professionals, genetic information and counseling and technical assistance are no longer being carried out, and so we're repealing it. We cleared this with the Minnesota Department of Health. They have no issues with this repealer, and so that's why we're here today.
Okay. I see no further discussion. And there's no other amendments? Okay. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Rapisky, 30 seconds, final word.
Thank you for hearing this bill today, Chair and fellow representatives. I renew my motion to recommend that House File 3544 as amended is re-referred to the General Registry.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and it's heading House File 3544 as amended is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The final bill we have for consideration today is House File 3516. Chair Schumacher, would you like to move House File 3516 to get it before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3516 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and
yes.
Means.
Yep. Thank you. And we have the bill before us, and Chair Schumacher, tell us about the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Board of Dentistry bill, and I will turn it over immediately to Bridget Anderson, the Executive Director for the Board of Dentistry, to walk us through what the board is
thank
requesting.
You. Yeah, and Ms. Anderson, you're on Zoom, so 90 seconds, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer and Bierman members, for the opportunity to speak on House File 3516. As Representative Schumacher mentioned, it is a Minnesota Board of Dentistry bill. It primarily makes a lot of technical and clarifying updates to existing statute that actually explains the length of the bill as well. So the terminology that aligns with the standards used in dental accrediting bodies is throughout the bill, and that's what you're seeing there. As far as any outdated references to dental school or schools and aligning that with dental and allied dental education programs. So it also removes other unnecessary language in other areas, including specialty dentist licensure restorative functions. It does add dental therapy to guest license provisions to be consistent with other allied dental professions, and updates the continuing education waiver language to related to lower income patients. It's a more appropriate term. So a lot of this, as I mentioned, it's a lot of technical change. I will point out that we do have
30-second warning.
What we think strengthens the public protection by adding felony criminal sexual misconduct to the grounds for discipline. So I think that it ensures that the statute reflects our current practice for the board, also improves clarity and supports the provision of dental services. And I'm happy to answer any questions. And also, you do have a House summary that really helps section by section you understand the impact of the bill. Thank you.
Yeah, there is a written testimony in the packets and online, folks. Is there anyone in the audience who wished to testify on House File 3516? Okay, I am not aware of any amendments on House File 3516. Further discussion to this bill? Hearing no further discussion, Chair Schumacher moves that House File 3516 be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. Is there any final words, Chair?
Nope.
No? Okay. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And House File 3516 is recommended to be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. Folks, see no further business. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.